This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.
Welcome to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Hi, I'm Jamie Bussin. I'm a former commercial litigator who used to weigh 242 pounds. When I was 38 years old, I lost over 50 pounds through a regimen of exercise and better nutrition. It took me a year to reach my goal, but I thought if a type A personality like me could do it, really anybody can. I'm still asking questions and learning about what it means to live a healthy lifestyle. Please join me on this continuing journey. Today, we'll discuss body contouring after weight loss with aesthetic surgeon Dr. Ron Somogyi. We'll learn about the neuroscience of music with neuroscientist, musician, and author, Dr. Robert Satori. We'll find out about the challenges of face-to-face communications with social engineer Christopher Hadnagy. And lastly, we'll discover mindfulness tips for back-to-school anxiety with Dr. Greg Hammer. Before we get to that, here's your tonic quick shot. Getting good sleep is very important for teenagers and bodybuilders alike. During deep sleep, your body produces a hormone called growth hormone, which helps build muscles, bones, and burns fat. Teens especially need this hormone to grow to their full height. Scientists at the University of California, Berkeley, studied how the brain controls this hormone during sleep. They found a special system in the brain that keeps growth hormone levels balanced. They used mice to study brain activity during different sleep stages and discovered that two brain chemicals, GHRH and somatostatin, control how much growth hormone is made. These chemicals act differently during REM and non-REM sleep. The hormone also affects a part of the brain called the locus coeruleus, which controls alertness and focus. When growth hormone builds up during sleep, it helps you wake up feeling alert. But if there's too much, it can cause sleepiness again. The balance between sleep and the hormones is important for growth, mental focus, and preventing diseases like diabetes and obesity. Researchers hope that their findings can lead to new treatments for sleep and brain-related problems in the future. Question: what's the best way to make sure you're getting the most up-to-date and accurate health and wellness information? Answer: the Tonic newsletter, of course. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. I'll be joined by Dr. Ron Somogyi in a moment, but first, a little bit of business. Does your reflection match how you feel, or are stubborn areas holding you back? At Form, Face, and Body, they specialize in restoring your youthful glow and sculpting the body you desire so your outer appearance reflects your inner vitality. Visit formfacebody.ca and see how they can help you rediscover your confidence. Call 416-447-6176 to schedule your complimentary consultation and reclaim your vitality. Dr. Ron Somogyi is a Toronto-based plastic and reconstructive surgeon at Form, Face, and Body. He trained at the University of Toronto in plastic and reconstructive surgery. He then went on to complete two fellowships in Melbourne, Australia. Each of those taught him new and innovative techniques and honed the unique cosmetic surgery skills he has brought back to his practice here in Toronto. Dr. Somogyi has been on full-time staff at North York General Hospital and Women's College Hospital since 2014. He maintains an active research interest in both cosmetic and reconstructive surgery and has recently published journal articles and book chapters on breast reconstruction, surgical safety, and breast augmentation. Welcome back to the show, sir. How are you?
Amazing. Thanks for having me.
So, regular listeners to the show know that when I was 38 years old, I lost 52 pounds. And it kind of changed my life. And it for certain changed my body. And one of the things that happens when you lose a lot of weight in a relatively short period of time, it took me a year, but that's still relatively short, is you get a lot of loose skin and your body looks very different. So I thought it would be interesting to bring the expert in to talk about what you can do in those circumstances and what you've seen when it comes to that type of surgery. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It's a big topic, and it's one that I'm very excited to talk about, very passionate about. It's something we spend a big proportion of our time looking after. I also want to know, I'll have to go back and learn about, you know, how you lost your weight, because these days people are losing a lot more weight and a lot of weight, maybe a little bit easier than people did in the past.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're probably dealing with a lot of people who've probably lost about 20, 25 pounds through using GLP agonists like Ozempic, et cetera, right? Like,
yeah.
Is that what you're seeing in your clinic?
We're seeing a lot of that. We still see a lot. I mean, patients that come to me, as you mentioned, if you've lost, you know, 50 pounds or 100 pounds, those are the more common patients. What's really interesting about those medications is that it's helping patients to maintain their weight loss, so they get to the point where they really want to do something about the loose skin, right? If it's a little bit of an up-down sort of thing, then you may not get to the cosmetic surgery part of it. But once you've been able to maintain things, which a lot of patients can do these days, that's where we really come in. So, you know, it's funny when patients come in and these consultations are very long, okay, because it's multiple areas very often. It's not just one thing, and nobody really knows where to start. The patients don't know where to start. So we really spend the first, you know, hour just talking about what really bothers them, of course, getting a good medical history, understanding how the weight came off, what the stability is like, all of those kinds of things. And then the rest of the conversation, it's remarkably straightforward. Not the planning part, we'll get into that, but I literally pinch and show in a mirror. And every patient says, oh, this is what I do in the mirror. And that's exactly what we do. We do what every patient that's lost a lot of weight does in the mirror. We do in the office. We look for those areas of loose skin, particularly the ones that are bothersome in clothing or with certain activities. And we look to remove that skin and tighten the areas around it. That's the overlying principle for body contouring after massive weight loss.
There's a huge psychological element when you lose that kind of weight. I can say that having done so, right? Like you're doing it for a number of reasons, perhaps for health reasons that's driving it. A lot of it is appearance. You know, you just don't want to carry that weight and how you feel about yourself. And I think that's crucial to what you do because, you know, it's such hard work, even if you're on the GLP agonist, to lose significant weight and you think your life is going to change and it's all going to be better. And then all of a sudden you're dealing with like loose skin and it's like, oh no, I put all this work in, what do I do next? And I would imagine a lot of your patients feel that way. Like they're exhausted from the effort of losing the weight and they just kind of want an immediate fix for this because they don't have a bandwidth to deal with this anymore.
Yeah, I would entirely agree, but I'd put a positive spin on it, which is a little bit selfish from my perspective, which is that these patients that have lost weight, as you say, it's so difficult and they've done it, which means that they are committed, driven people with the ability to achieve a goal. And for us as a surgeon that's going to do something that can be complicated, that's going to take some recovery, we know they're going to get through it. They've already accomplished something that's much harder than what I'm going to bring them on to. So, you know, from our perspective, I absolutely love the commitment that these patients have. It's why every time I sit down, I walk into the room and I know how much weight they've lost. And I literally just look at them and say, I'm amazed by you. If I can help now to get you to the next stage, it would be my absolute honor, because it's a totally different concept than somebody who just wants to change something that, you know, bothers them. That's important too. But this is after, in most cases, years of effort, years of effort.
For sure. So talk us through the procedures. Like, so somebody comes in, they've lost significant weight, and I appreciate there's a huge difference between somebody who's big boned and loses 50 and somebody who's smaller and who's lost 100. Those are different situations, but can you kind of walk us through what you do when they come in and where you go from there?
Yeah, for sure. So the first thing, and what I would encourage anybody who fits this group to think about, is what bothers you the most? That's really the question. And it's the first question I ask patients. And I ask it because the answers are remarkable. I have patients that have huge amounts of excess skin around, let's say, their tummy area, which is very common. But they come in and they say, my arms really bother me. And it's the last thing I thought, but it doesn't matter what I think, right?
Yeah.
So that's the most important, and it's the first thing. So we start with what is the most important thing. And then we try to prioritize other areas. So let's just say it's this different example of the arms. So the arms bother the patient. There's a lot of loose. They like to wear tank tops and things like that. Okay. And they say, what's the next thing? And say, well, you know, when I wear clothes, my bras don't fit, or, you know, there's a lot of loose skin on my chest. So I say, okay, now let's think about what we can do to combine those two areas. Because, of course, if we get down the list and there's five or six areas that bother a patient, and that would traditionally be five or six different surgeries, that's never going to happen. It's not going to happen from a time off of work, from a safety, and from a cost perspective. And so today, what's really different about these kinds of procedures and what experts have really been able to do is to safely and effectively combine different areas. And there are, of course, rules what things can be combined effectively and what cannot, but that's really what that first consultation is about. It's trying to prioritize the areas that bother the patient and then me speaking through with them how we can combine things and get them through, you know, 1 4- or 5-hour surgery and a 4 or 5 week recovery as opposed to, you know, 4 or 5 2-hour surgeries.
Can you tell if a patient's ready for this type of surgery? Like what do you see that makes for a good candidate for that? And I presume emotionally.
Yeah. So I was hoping you were going to say that because it really is split in two. Again, there's the technical part of it. So I look at actually how much weight they've lost and how much weight is left on them, or in terms of weight that we need to remove. We look at stability. That's really, really important because we want our results to last forever. And so a lot of patients come in sort of halfway through their weight loss journey. And I say, that's great. Good time to start the conversation. But we wouldn't want to tighten everything up and then lose another 20, 30, 40 pounds. Then things are loose again. We retighten. Right. So we want really long-standing, long-term results for patients. So that's technically what I look at. And of course, their general health, very important. But mentally and emotionally is a huge part. And again, that starts the minute our coordinators speak to the patient on the phone. We're asking personal questions. We're asking questions about their life, their support system. Does their family know or friends know that they're looking to do this? It's really, really important. And in most cases, our patients in this population, again, so goal-driven and are so accomplished in that they've lost the weight already, they come with that emotional stability. And so for us, it really becomes about making a plan and getting the courage to just go through with it.
So I think you mentioned something off the top that resonates with me, and it's an issue for anybody that's lost significant weight. It is hard to lose the weight. It is perhaps harder to keep it off. And I would imagine you have to concern yourself with what happens if these people put the weight back on, right?
Yeah, tremendously. It's just so disappointing for everybody. Fortunately, from the very beginning of our practice, we've made it an absolute goal to make that a priority, is the weight stability and maintenance. And so a lot of that is before we do anything. So understanding the patient and how they drive themselves,
right,
and what their stability has been. But it's also in, again, the partnerships. I think I mentioned this time or last time we were speaking about how incredible our team is. So first of all, our team spends a lot of time understanding the patient and if they're going to be able to maintain this for a long time. But we also have very important partnerships with weight loss experts and weight maintenance experts that we put our patients in touch with very, very closely. And whether that's on the exercise side, on the diet nutrition side, or on the medical weight loss, like the GLP-1 agonist side of things. And all of those things, when we do all of that, and we do it for every single patient, really does ensure a near 100% success rate in weight maintenance. Between the surgery and the partnerships that we have, these patients just do incredibly well. But if you just went at it as, you know, they lost weight, now we do the surgery, those numbers traditionally have not been nearly as good.
I think you mentioned off the top how a lot of these types of patients, I wouldn't use the word willpower, maybe they're type A personalities. They're motivated to take the steps necessary to lose the weight. So they tend to be good candidates to keep it off. But unfortunately, you know the way things work, right? You know that as you get older, it's harder to keep the weight off, or maybe you get busier and you can't exercise. So do you have to factor that in when you're proposing the surgery? Is there a leeway, or are there ways for you to sort of think about that? Like, is there a buffer zone? Or
for sure. And I think that's where I do lean on, first of all, total honesty and transparency with patients. So yeah. For example, a patient that tells me right off the bat, well, I'm perimenopausal, I've been struggling with weight coming up and down. And so we talk about that, and we talk about how things are going to change no matter what we do. We're going to give you a beautiful result. You're going to be super happy, but you're going to age like a normal person. And that is entirely normal. So we have very candid conversations about that. But again, that's where I really lean heavily on our partners, people that help us to look after patients, specifically weight loss patients, that understand how life changes, how age affects things, and they can help. Sometimes it's hormones, sometimes it is some of these medications, and sometimes it's a lot of psychological, you know, and lifestyle type of changes.
What makes someone an expert in post-weight loss surgery or taking care of really loose or extra skin?
Well, first of all, it's a commitment, right? So, you know, the thing that we share with our patients, they come in having had made a real commitment and now making another one towards the shape of their body and restoring that. We make a commitment to looking after them from the minute they walk into the office until, you know, 6 months later when they forgot that they ever had any surgery. And, you know, these are relatively big surgeries in the scale of cosmetic surgery. And so there's lots of things that come up, whether it's, you know, areas of persistent loose skin, it's wounds that aren't healing as quickly as we want, or scars that don't look as nice as we expected. All of these things happen in very small proportions, except that when you're doing big surgery, the proportions, of course, get a little bit higher. And so understanding that, these are not surprising to us. They're not frustrating or annoying to us. They're just part of how we look after patients. So, you know, my nurse is an expert in specifically looking after all of these problems I just mentioned and a few more. And so she expects patients to call. She preempts them and says, you know, on week three, this is what you might experience. Give me a call, send me a photo. We're going to talk through it. We're going to figure out what to do. And so what makes us experts is anticipating, understanding what's going to happen and being fully capable and happy to look after these things.
So the happy part, I'm sure for you, is you get to see how these surgeries change people's lives. So what happens when people get these types of surgery?
Yeah, I don't even know how to answer it because I literally get emotional. I can't tell you how many patients cry and then I end up, you know, having a little teary
a moment,
eye.
A moment.
There's a moment for sure. And we all do. Like it's usually myself and the nurse in the room and we take a bandage off. And so many times I hear patients say, I didn't think this was possible. You know, and that to me is the most unbelievable thing. And then I see them 6 months later and they come in their gym outfit and they're living their best life. And I mean, there's just absolutely nothing better than that.
So surgery like this, and in particular, there might be multiple surgeries required, seems like a really big deal and probably some cost attached to it. Is this really something that patients should be considering? Like let's have some honest talk about, you know, what it goes into this.
Yeah, it's the biggest remaining problem with this. We've really worked on the techniques and looking after patients and all the things we talked about. The financial bit is still significant, and we talk about it again. The minute the patient calls, we don't get the patients in, then tell them. We go through all of this in the beginning, and it's just another example of a commitment that the patient needs to make, right? It's a long-term thing. When I say that, you know, a good example is financing. We have lots of financing options. I don't really get into it. I stick to the surgical part, but we have a team that sits with the patient. And just like any major purchase that's going to last you, you know, many years, a car, a house, your body, right? We sit down and we talk about the financing and we figure out how it works for your life. And it's a commitment, but, you know, it's a commitment that has an unbelievable result.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Real pleasure. That was a lot of fun. Thank you.
That was Dr. Ron Somogyi. We have to take a short break, but we'll be right back on The Tonic. For more than 30 years, Genestra brands have been trusted by health professionals across Canada. Their supplements are supported by scientific research and manufactured to meet high-quality standards. By combining traditional use with modern clinical evidence, Genestra provides professional-grade supplements that support your health. Learn more about their full range of products at genestra.ca. I'd like to give a shout out to our long-standing sponsor, Omega Alpha. This company is 100% Canadian owned. Their team consists of allopathic and naturopathic doctors, nutritionists, researchers, and other scientific professionals, all led by their CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Formulations are created on their 40,000 square foot facility located in Toronto. Omega Alpha uses only the highest quality ingredients to manufacture the most efficacious yet price-friendly nutraceuticals. For more information about Omega Alpha, visit OmegaAlpha.com.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Robert Sartori was born and raised in Buenos Aires, Argentina. He studied music and psychology at Boston University and obtained his PhD at Brown University, followed by postdoctoral work at Montreal Neurological Institute of McGill University, where he currently holds a Canada Research Chair. His laboratory studies the neural substrates of auditory cognition, focusing on two characteristically human abilities, speech and music. Together with his many students and collaborators, he has published more than 300 scientific papers on topics including pitch perception, musical imagery, musical production, brain plasticity, hemispheric specialization, and the role of the reward system in musical pleasure. Welcome to the show, Dr. Sartori. How are you?
Hello, Jamie. It's nice to hear from you.
So why do you think... Well, maybe this is the wrong question. I was going to say, why do you think everybody loves music? But does everybody love music?
That's a really good question, because I really thought so until a few years ago when we're discussing, you know, is this really true? And no one had really studied it. So we went out and sort of canvassed people. And turns out there's a small but significant group of people, something like 2%, 3% of the population, who really don't enjoy music. And there's... You know, it's important to say there's nothing like wrong with these folks. They simply don't like music, even though they get enjoyment from every other, you know, everyday activity, like hanging out with friends or eating a delicious meal or going to a movie.
Are they neurodivergent? So, for example, some people who are on the spectrum, you know, don't like loud noises or certain types of noises. Is that what's going on here, or are they a different cohort?
No, it's a different cohort. I mean, I think it's appropriate to say it's, you know, part of diversity. Different brains are wired in different ways, but we've actually identified the exact sort of wiring difference. It has to do with the way the auditory part of the brain is connected to the reward part of the brain, which is the part that gives us pleasure. So in their case, that particular pathway is sort of underdeveloped, very likely from birth. So it's just a different way of experiencing the world, if you will. But it gives us insight, in fact, into how the majority of people do enjoy music, because in the majority of people, that same pathway is really very well developed. So studying those folks actually helped us understand more about music and why it gives us pleasure.
So I guess that would also speak to why certain people like certain types of music and certain other people perhaps don't. Is that true?
Well, that's a very separate question, I would say. So the people that we call... that we say have musical anhedonia are the people who just don't enjoy any kind of music, you know,
right.
no matter what it is. Majority of people who do enjoy music have particular preferences. They like one genre of music, and they sometimes, you know, really hate some other genre. And there are many factors that are relevant for this. Most have to do with what I would describe as exposure to music or enculturation or, you know, the culture in which you grow up, the country you grow up in, the language you speak, all these things are important. And particularly important is what music you were listening to in adolescence, in other words, with your peer group. Because what happens in adolescence is that you want to kind of differentiate yourself from your parents, and you want to grow up and be your own person. And you are, doing things with people of your own age. And so... music is a big part of that, because it forms part of your own, like, personal culture. And there's another really interesting factor, which is that adolescence, the dopamine system really kicks in. This is the system that regulates the reward system. So it's not a surprise that in adolescence, that's the time we first fall in love, right? That's, everyone has that experience. And we first really fall in love with music. And those things are all interrelated.
We do little science bits off the top of the show, and one we did recently... and actually landed in our newsletter as well, is there appears to be a psychedelic effect with people who listen to music and who do certain breathing exercises. Does any of your work touch upon any of that?
No, we haven't done that work, but it's interesting that there is increased interest in the medical community these days on the use of psychedelics. It's not something I've studied particularly, but what's interesting is that in these sort of medical applications, music is always part of the therapy. They always include music along with, you know, controlled dosages of psychedelics. So there's an interesting area for research there.
So you've mentioned dopamine now twice. Is that one of the pathways in which, you know, our love of music is sort of expressed, or are there other ways?
Yeah, so this is probably one of the most important discoveries we ever made in our lab. Was about 20 years ago or so when we did brain scans on people, and we have a way of testing for dopamine response in the brain using brain scans. And we found that when people were listening to music that they reported to be highly pleasurable, there was dopamine release in the reward system. And this didn't happen for music that they thought was not pleasurable. So it was really about their experience if they were feeling the pleasure. And then with some colleagues in Europe, we did some experiments where we administered some drugs that block dopamine. And we observed that when that drug is administered, people no longer feel the pleasure. So it really seems like dopamine is the key molecule that is responsible for the pleasure. And this is already known in other domains. It just wasn't known for music. In other words, it was already established that, for example, if you give a hungry rat some food and you measure with an electrode the response in the brain, it will release dopamine. So this is a very potent signal, right?
Yeah.
But what's interesting is that music is not like food, right? It's not a primary reinforcer. It's not something that is required for survival the way food is. It's an abstract stimulus that depends on learning, depends on culture, et cetera. And yet it activates the same very basic survival system. So that's kind of an interesting feature of music.
But isn't, like, don't our minds require stimulation? I mean, isn't like when you talk about people getting older and living longer, you talk about neuroplasticity and sort of learning new things and exercising your mind. And I would think that music would play a role in that, right? It's a stimulus.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So it's very much a stimulus, and it's a stimulus which is complex and which evolves over time as you listen to music. It, you know, takes a certain amount of time. And one interesting aspect of music that we think it explains why the dopamine system is recruited when you're listening to it is that as it unfolds over time, there are surprises going on. In other words, musicians are always very aware of this. When I talk to performers or composers, arrangers, they always tell me, well, of course, I try to always introduce something slightly unexpected, a little twist, something unusual, because that keeps the listener going, right?
Yeah.
And so this is the interesting part about the stimulation. It's not just that it's stimulating itself, but also that as you're listening, you're making a prediction about what's going to happen. And then if it's a really good piece of music or a really good performer, that performer is going to do something tricky, right?
Yeah.
They're going to spend a little more time than you expected, or they're going to introduce a new riff that, you know, wasn't in the previous version. It was going to be a modulation from one key to another that was unexpected. And so this really keeps your mind quite active, because as you're listening, you're also learning, right? You're memorizing that music, whether you're actively or consciously doing so or not. Your brain is keeping track of what's going on and keeping track of those regularities. And whenever there's something unexpected, that's actually when you get the biggest dopamine peak, is when something different happens.
Okay, let's talk about music and not necessarily dopamine, but the motor system. So I used to be a DJ once upon a time. So, you know, like music also drives dance. And I've also been a spinning instructor. And also when I exercise, I find, you know, music helps things along. So is there actually a connection, or is there not a connection between those systems?
Yeah. Well, there is literally a connection. The white matter of the brain are the connections, are the axons that link up one region to another. And when we study this, we see that the auditory part of the brain is also connected very directly to the motor part of the brain, the part that controls your muscles and so forth. And we even see that if I put you in a brain scanner and I play very rhythmic music to you, I will see responses in your brain from the motor system, coming from the motor system. Even if you're lying perfectly still, the motor part of the brain is still active, and it's active in a rhythmic way. In other words, it's following the rhythm, and it's also anticipating the rhythm. This is really important, because your body, in order to dance, for example, right, you have to be on the beat. So you can't send the commands to your body to, you know, move your hips in time to the rhythm, after the sound has already occurred.
Right.
That command has to go before the sound has occurred. Otherwise, it'll be late, right?
Yeah.
Otherwise, it'll be off the beat. So the motor part of the brain, the part that controls the muscles of your body, is very directly linked to the auditory part of the brain. We actually can see that when we measure, for example, the white matter, which is the part of the brain that links up one region with another. And we also see that the motor part of the brain is active as you listen to rhythmic music. Even if you're not moving, even if you're perfectly still lying in a brain scanner, we still see the motor part of the brain responding. And it's responding in a very particular way. It's anticipating when the next beat will occur. So in order to dance to the beat of the music, for example, you cannot wait for the sound to occur, and then you send the command to the legs or to the hips to move in time with the beat, because then you would be too late. You would be off. You would be not synchronous with the beat. You would be off. And therefore, you had to send the command before in order to be aligned. And what that means is that the brain is making a prediction. It's not just waiting for something to occur. It's anticipating that the next beat will occur in X milliseconds and then sending the command. And this is what allows people to dance. And by the way, this is a very common and simple ability that even very young children express. You don't have to be taught exactly. I mean, you can become a real dancer, yes, and that takes years of practice to do certain moves that are very tricky. But even a young child, even a toddler, will just start to, you know, wave their body around when they hear music. And it's also something we even do, you know, in old age when you have dementia. Some people are still able to manage to dance around or to at least tap along to music, and they seem to enjoy that even when some of their other abilities have declined.
Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed talking to you.
We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss face-to-face communication on The Tonic. Does your skin need some pampering? Treat yourself to a luxurious exotic oil from New Roots Herbal. Organic or wild-crafted, these oils are sourced from around the globe and tested to ensure purity. Never diluted, they're rich in vitamins and nutrients for radiant, healthy-looking skin. Choose from a wide variety including argan, rosehip, or skin lover's blend. Now available in a stunning gift set, perfect for that special someone. Available only at fine health food stores.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Christopher Hadnagy is a trailblazer in the realm of social engineering and a master hacker. His vast experience in the field, from training law enforcement professionals to speaking at renowned events like RSA and Black Hat, highlights his authority. He's the best-selling author of several technical books on security, including Social Engineering, The Art of Human Hacking. And to find out more about him, you can go to his websites, social-engineering.com and humanhackingbook.com. Welcome back to the show, Chris. How are you?
Thanks. Good to be here.
So today we're going to talk about something that I think is a lost art, which is face-to-face communication. But before we do that, even though you've been a regular guest on the show, we should probably explain, you know, what social engineering is. And then, you know, if you want to take step number two, how does it apply to face-to-face communication and not just sort of the digital realm?
Yeah, I think it's a good place to start, because a lot of times when people look up or think about social engineering, they always apply it to the malicious side. So they say that manipulating people to do something. But in my research over the last 20 years, I've kind of defined social engineering as any act that influences a person to take an action that may or may not be in their best interest. So yes, it can be used maliciously, but it's basically the science of understanding how humans make decisions, how they like to communicate those decisions, and then using influence principles to influence that decision.
Okay, so you and I have had these discussions before, and it's my thesis, and you don't feel free not to agree with me if you don't feel the same way, but I find that people are challenged in direct communication, you know, talking at a cocktail party, talking when they're going out for dinner, having interactions with coworkers face-to-face, or just meeting people because of a number of factors of modern life. And I would identify internet, social media, and basically our shortening attention span. Do you agree with me or do you see other factors at play?
No, I 100% agree. And I think that when COVID happened and we were forced to alienate from each other and go to a completely digital type of communication, that made it 10 times worse. And if you just like, and I hate to even use the platform because it's just turned to garbage, but X used to be Twitter.
Yeah.
It is just like one giant platform of hate speech. You know, like you could say anything you want to anyone. So when you communicate like that, and now you come face to face with a person, you're like, oh, wait, I can't talk that way. And people just lose their confidence, their mojo, their ability to actually have words with another human being face to face.
You know, I used to be a lawyer. And, you know, when you go to law school, you have to read a lot of cases, right? And those cases, ridiculously, you know, the higher up you go, the longer the cases, right? In some instances, when it got to the Supreme Court in Canada, you know, that you're looking at 300-page decisions, like no joke, right? Which is like a book, right? And you know, a short one at the Supreme Court, and those are obviously the leading cases, might be 150 pages. Whereas now, you know, I can barely make it through a New York Times article. And, you know, it's not senility. I'm not there yet.
No.
But my attention span has completely shortened, you know, for everything. Like I can't watch TV or movies or anything the way I used to. I have to really force myself to pay attention. This must be happening for everybody.
Well, we call it, I mean, I don't know if everyone would agree with me, but I call it the TikTok age, right?
Yeah.
We have been trained by social media that, you know, you're going to make a 3-course meal. You better be able to show that to me in 60 seconds or I'm done with you. Yeah. Right?
So right.
I don't want to sit here for an hour masterclass. No, show me how to do this in 60 seconds. Give me the recipe and leave me alone. So we got into this mental state where we expect things to be delivered immediately and super fast with clear understanding. And if you don't do that in your messaging, you're going to lose.
A sidebar, but like I'm finding that with the show now. Now I'm marketing more on social media. It's really hard to take a health and wellness issue and whittle it down to 15 seconds. Like it's almost impossible. Yeah. Like it's meaningless. But let's circle back to face-to-face communication. Knowing all that we know, let's start applying some of your skills so that people can have better conversations and gain people's trust. So what would you recommend to people?
Okay, I got a clear path for like having an amazing conversation with anybody. If you're going to approach someone for a conversation, the first thing to do is put your phone away.
Yeah.
Don't have it in your hands. Put it away. Put it in your back pocket. Put it in your purse. Just put it away. If you're holding it and it vibrates or dings, you're gonna feel the need to look down. Breaking that eye contact, breaking that nonverbal connection is a clear path to being like, you don't really care about me. So don't have your phone. And if you have to, because it's an emergency, say that. Hey, I'm really sorry. I got to hold my phone. My kid's getting off the bus and he needs to call me or something. I have to be available. Whatever. Just be honest about it if you have to. But if you can, put the phone away. Second is use of questions. And we're talking open-ended questions, not the close-ended like, hey, you know, is there a good restaurant around here? Well, that's a yes or no. You want to have a good open question like, hey, I live in Orlando. So you might meet somebody, a stranger, and be like, hey, so what are you doing here in Orlando? Do you live here or you're on vacation? You know, and now you have a question that's open-ended. They're going to answer. But now here is the most critical point. As the conversation gets engaging, you have to perform active listening.
Yeah.
And active listening is the art of listening with the intent of hearing and understanding and not thinking about what you're going to say next. The second you start thinking about your next words, you're not listening and the conversation could take a wrong turn.
And people are cognizant of it. There's lots of, you find yourself in a conversation and, you know, I live in my head. So I do think about what I'm going to respond or, you know, where I'd like to take the conversation. But I actually have to turn off that little skill if I'm trying to engage with somebody, because it's very rare that you can do it and still seem genuine, I would say.
Yeah.
And I
agree.
And I think authenticity is what we're missing. You know, to be a good communicator, you actually have to be yourself and present yourself that way. And part of that, I think, is being open to that communication to the extent that you are, right?
And one of the things I teach first on that point is understanding communication profiling. And I'm not talking about profiling the other person at first. It's understanding yours, right? Yep. So I'm what would be considered a D communicator, which is very direct. The strength of a D communicator is I can be direct. I can be straightforward. I can take criticism. But the cons of a D communicator is I can be a jackass sometimes.
Yep.
You know, I could just be too blunt. I could be too straightforward and turn people off. Well, if I know that, right? If I know that that is the way I am and I have the capacity to be that jerk at times, then if I'm in a conversation with someone and they say something I don't agree with, well, now I can say, hey, Chris, don't let that part out, right? Don't become a jerk. Like, that's just their opinion and they're allowed to have opinions that differ from yours. You know, you have to have that internal dialogue. Once you profile yourself, now you can profile the other person so you can see if there's any adjustments in your communication style that could be more effective in communicating with that person.
Yeah, but you know, as a fellow blunt instrument, I can tell you sometimes you really just need to get what you need to get off your chest.
I agree.
You know, like, I agree. So I can't help myself. And there have been instances when I've done it and I've immediately regretted it, right? Like I can elicit laughs because I'm like lightning fast. But along with being that blunt and that quick comes like the shame of overstepping your boundaries, right? Like it happens to me all the time. It sounds like you and I are quite similar in that regard.
Oh man, one of my biggest, I'm still training myself. I'm married 30 years, 31 years coming up. And you know, my wife will come out and I'm like, "Ooh, you're gonna wear that?"
Yeah.
I mean, that is just like, what are you doing, dummy? Like, yeah. No.
And you know what you're doing when you're doing it, Chris. I mean, be honest, right? You know.
Yeah, it's coming out. And I'm like, I don't really think that looks great, but it's coming out and I could have said it way differently.
100%.
And it comes out like a lead balloon, right?
I hear you. I'm still working on it too. But you know, it's part of our charm, I would think, right? Like people, that's part of our authenticity. Take it or leave it. I mean, that's what I'm told. You know, people say, you know, you can be a really big jerk, but I get you, right? So, you know, it's a yin-yang thing.
One of the things that my team likes about it is that they have no problem coming to me and telling me if they disagree with something or saying that I did something that upset them. And that's the strength of it,
I agree.
Is that people that are with you or that work for you or work with you or your family knows that they can come to you and say, hey, that was kind of stupid. Like, I really didn't like that.
Yeah.
And you'll go, oh, man, I didn't know. Okay, sorry, let me work on that. And we're not going to have an argument because you had to tell me something.
Okay, enough about us. Let's talk about people that aren't like us. We've discussed this briefly before, but let's talk about body language, tone, or eye contact in terms of building rapport in a relationship.
Yeah, so there's a couple really key points. First of all, eye contact. It's this sounds easy, but it's something that you really have to work on because you don't want to have intense eye contact with the person. That's creepy. That doesn't feel good.
Right.
A normal conversation, you look at the person, but you also have time looking away. And you have to practice that. So you don't want to be looking away the whole time, and you don't want to be staring intently. So there's this middle ground where you have that eye contact. But now, even more important is our hips point to where we're interested. So if you're walking up to a complete stranger, you probably don't want to be full-on facing your hips at them right away because you don't know them. They don't know you. And let's say it's a member of the opposite sex. That's creepy. It's going to come on like, hey, I'm hitting on you. But if you start the conversation where you're kind of blading away from the person, and as the conversation gets engaging, you turn slowly, you'll notice something. It'll be really interesting because I'm mirroring. They'll turn towards you. And that's a great sign that you're actually building rapport and then having an engaging conversation with that person.
Let's switch roles. What are some of the indications that perhaps somebody's trying to manipulate you in a conversation? What should be you looking for?
Yeah, that's a great question. So a lot of times manipulators, they'd like to use strong emotions, right? That's one of the first cues in anything. They'll try to use fear, or they'll try to use greed or lust or anger, right? They'll try to elicit a strong emotion out of you because, and they might not understand the neuroscience behind it, but there is actually science behind this. When our amygdala is engaged because of fear, let's say, it actually starts processing psychological and physiological responses and it shuts down our frontal cortex. It's actually not operational. And this has been proven by Dr. Daniel Goleman in a study that he did. He wrote a book on emotional intelligence where he did this study and proved that this is what happens. So now think about that. If your amygdala is hijacked, you're feeling fear, you're feeling surprise, you're feeling lust, whatever it is, the next decision you make is not being made with your logic centers. Hmm. It's being made out of pure emotion. So manipulators will almost always use strong emotion and try to get you triggered so that way your decision making capabilities are down.
Interesting.
I mean, well, actually, let's think about it, right? So let's take it out of face to face for a second.
Yeah.
Grandma gets a phone call. This is the IRS. Yeah. You haven't paid your taxes. We're stopping your Social Security.
Yeah.
Intense fear, right? Mom gets a call. We have your daughter. Transfer money or we're going to kill her.
Yeah.
Like fear, right? Phishing email comes in, says, oh, look, your credit card was used for this massive purchase. You know, click here now. Fear, right? All these pretexts that we see being used by manipulators involve fear. But now let's take it to in person. You know, unbelievable job. I'm sitting in, I have a conference in Vegas. I'm sitting out there. And I'm sitting at the bar after a long day, just having a drink. And this unbelievably attractive woman comes in and sits next to me. She does not look like a prostitute at all. And she goes, oh, are you here for the conference? And I'm like, oh, yeah, you too? And she's like, yeah. And I'm like, oh, that's cool. We start talking. And she's like, man, you look a little tense. I'm like, I had a long day. I was training all day. She goes, hey, you know, would you like a massage? I offer massage services. Oh,
yeah.
Interesting, right?
Yeah.
Interesting. And I'm like, oh. Okay, now I see what's happening. I said, I don't think my wife would appreciate that very much, but thank you. And she walked away, right? Now, she was very attractive. She looked high class. And she came and sat down and didn't right away say, let's go have sex. She started with, you know, and I could tell you, I could see it in my head as the conversation got engaging. She turned her legs towards me. Her hips were facing me. And I was oblivious, like completely oblivious to what was about to happen because she told me she was with the conference. So I thought she was just another attendee. And later on, I was talking to the bartender, and he's like, yeah, you know what they do? They get you in the room. And then when they offer sex, they go, okay, give me a second. I got to go to the bathroom. They unlock the door. Two guys come in, beat you down, take your money, your laptop, your wallet, and leave. And you can't report it because you hired a prostitute. So if you report that, you're getting arrested for prostitution. So guys end up like lying, saying they got mugged or something. I'm like, it's a really perfect trap, but they're using a strong emotion to manipulate you into a situation that is really bad for you.
Okay, I would love to discuss Trade Vegas Tales with you because it's my happy place, but unfortunately we're out of time. Will you come back and we can revisit this discussion?
I love coming on your show, so anytime.
That was Christopher Hatanagy. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss back to school mindfulness on The Tonic.
For over 40 years, the Big Carrot has been the community's go-to for fresh, local, and organic goodness. As a worker-owned natural food market, the Big Carrot is all about healthy living, sustainability, and bringing people together. They've got everything you need, from vibrant produce and bulk goodies to natural body care and wellness advice to keep you feeling amazing. And their kitchen and juice bars, serving up deliciousness every single day. Now, as they celebrate 41 incredible years, they're inviting everyone to join the fun. Head to thebigcarrot.ca to discover more, and follow them on Instagram at The Big Carrot for a chance to win big in their anniversary giveaways.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Greg Hammer, MD, is a recently retired professor at Stanford University School of Medicine, pediatric intensive care physician, pediatric anesthesiologist, wellness and mindfulness lecturer, and the author of A Mindful Teen, Helping Today's Teenagers Thrive Through Gratitude, Acceptance, Intention, and Non-Judgment. Dr. Hammer was the chair of the Physician Wellness Task Force for the California Society of Anesthesiologists, as well as a former member of the Stanford Well MD Initiative. He has been a visiting professor and lecturer on wellness at institutions worldwide and has taught the GAIN method to medical students, residents, and fellows at Stanford. Welcome back to the show, Dr. Hammer. How are you?
Great to be with you, Jamie. As I said before we were on the air, I'm just getting over COVID, so I may sound a little congested, but boy, it's good to be back up on my feet.
Yeah, I would imagine. I hear you. So today we're going to focus a little bit on a cohort that we usually don't on this show, and that's people going back to school, whether they're children, teenagers, or young adults, or even people going back to school after, a gap and picking up on stuff. And this is as a result of your newest book. So why do you think people feel so anxious about going back to school?
I think there are several reasons, Jamie, for anyone going back to school. I suppose for young adults or adults going back to school, some of the issues with younger kids may be a little bit different, but gun violence is one. Many schools have metal detectors. People do have to do drills about You know, what if a shooter were in the building? Something that probably you and certainly I never had to deal with. I think for younger people in particular, social media, there's bullying, shaming, things like sextortion, which is a word that I never would have dreamed of 10 years ago even.
Yeah.
The political divide, I think, you know, people on the left and right in the U.S. are very divided. Obviously, this has had a, you know, impact on our relationship with Canadians to some degree, although I hope that most of them understand that most of us love Canada, you know, just second to the United States. But still, the political divide affects relationships within families, family get-togethers, certainly affects relationships with friends and schoolmates. Then there's drugs, which have become more prevalent and more dangerous, particularly with fentanyl, which as an anesthesiologist, a drug I'm very familiar with. And then, you know, among other things, kids who are applying to college are under a tremendous amount of pressure now. I think it's more competitive than ever. And, you know, kids start having to prepare earlier and earlier, well before they're in high school. So there are just a list of things that kids have to worry about related to school that just didn't exist before. And there's other issues too, eco-anxiety, you know, is there going to be an earth that's viable for my children and grandchildren? And then things that have been sort of more longstanding, like the economy. There's just a litany of things that create anxiety and perhaps even depression among students.
Let's focus on younger students now and the parents of those students. What do you see as the role of those parents in mitigating their kids' anxiety when it comes like to going back to school, for example?
Well, I think that, first of all, parents need to have open channels of communication with their kids, of course. I mean, these are just basic sort of first principles in parenting. And I'm not a psychiatrist or, you know, particularly an expert on parenting. I've had two teenagers. I've treated teenagers my whole life. I have, you know, my domestic partner has a teenage girl. The two of them have a beautiful relationship. But in any case, parents need to have very open relationships with their kids. They need to talk. They need to be non-judgmental, which is the N in GAIN, as you know. And that particularly obtains when it comes to things like kids who have been shamed or bullied. They need to be able to talk to their parents, kids who may have been victims of sextortion. And AI is another thing that we didn't mention, but makes some of the incursions into kids' personal lives even more realistic and easy. So parents need to have open channels of communication, be non-judgmental, teach their kids principles of gratitude, acceptance, intention, and non-judgment, and in particular, be non-judgmental when it comes to talking to their kids.
Good advice. So two of those topics, which sound like new things, sextortion we've covered extensively in a harrowing episode of this show, and we're going to be dealing with AI psychosis in a coming episode. So I'm familiar with all these terms, and our listeners will be too. Let's talk about mindfulness generally as a tool to help with all these pressures and anxieties that kids may be feeling. Like, can kids actually use mindfulness? Is this something that can be taught that early?
Oh, yes. I think kids as young as 4 or 5 can be taught some of the essentials of mindfulness. So the mindfulness method that I wrote about in my first book, Gain Without Pain, and the second one, A Mindful Teen, is based on, starts with a brief morning practice involving slow, deep, deliberate breathing and a self-guided tour through the principles of gain, gratitude, acceptance, intention, non-judgment, and then return to pure focus on the breath can be done very quickly. And it helps us rewire our brains in the context of a couple of properties our brains have that are sort of hardwired by evolution, I think. One of them is that we tend to be very negative. We have a negativity bias. We tend to remember the negative and forget the positive, and that certainly involves kids as well. And the other is we're very distracted. Our minds go to the future and the past, and combined with our negativity, when overthinking the future, we develop anxiety. And overthinking the past and mistakes we've made, things that are embarrassing, especially for young kids, this leads to depression and suicidal ideation and sometimes even suicide. So this is something that parents can embrace themselves and then set as an example for their kids. And, you know, for example, they could have a little gratitude practice before they sit down to dinner, or, you know, they could have a talk about acceptance while they're driving their child to soccer practice. You know, what are things we can change that bother us? What are things we can't change, and how do we accept the latter? So there are many ways that parents can both set an example, practice mindfulness themselves, and therefore really be in a position to help teach their kids, even starting at a young age.
I know we've discussed it before on the show, but for those who haven't heard those episodes, can you just walk us through GAIN in a few minutes?
Sure. Well, again, the idea is rewiring our brains away from being so negative and unable to be present, because the present moment is really the only moment we truly experience, right? The future's not here yet. The past is just a number of memories, which essentially are thoughts. So how do we be more present? Because present is where happiness resides, right? All of our happiest moments are when we're not thinking about tomorrow or yesterday. We're walking through a pine forest, enjoying the smells, the sun filtering through the treetops, our footfall on the soft pine floor. Being present is really essential, but it's not our natural state. And so we need to have a practice. We need to have the I in GAIN, in fact, is intention. So the practice starts in the morning, ideally, on a daily basis. We just carve out 3 minutes to sit in a comfortable chair, close our eyes, focus on breathing slowly in, perhaps to a count of three, pausing to a count of three, and then releasing the breath slowly to a count of four. We do that a few times. And then, as I said, we just do a self-guided tour of that for which we're grateful, the G in GAIN. And most of us have so much for which to be grateful. We, you know, we read about all these terrible things happening in the world, which is a source of anxiety for young kids, but we can be grateful for what we have, the roof over our head, the food on the table, the family, the friends, the loved ones, the pets. And then we transition to the A in GAIN, which is acceptance. And, you know, we are bothered by all the terrible things going on in the world, and including in the United States, the poverty, the lack of access to health care, but also, you know, war and violence around the world and so on. And determining what we can accept, what we cannot change, and what we must therefore accept. And really just thinking about that for a few minutes. And then we transition to the I in GAIN, which is intention. We just sort of reaffirm our efforts, our desire to rewire our brains, to be more present, to be generous, to be kind to other people, etc. And we do this all while we're continuing to do this slow, deep, deliberate breathing. And then we transition to the N in GAIN. And I like to teach, maybe have an image of the Earth apparently suspended in space, one of these beautiful NASA images. And the Earth is just a planet. It's neither good nor bad. There's no judgment, right? It's just what it is. So it's only logical for me to think that I, too, am neither good nor bad. There's no judgment. I simply am the person I am. And we rest in our breath as we do this. And then we just return to a pure focus on the breath and slowly open our eyes. And what we're doing, Jamie, as you know, is we're kind of reestablishing neural networks in our brain. We're reestablishing pathways that establish essentially our thoughts and bringing them more into the present and more into a positive way of being.
What do you think are reasonable expectations for the GAIN practice for kids and young teens? Like, how will the changes manifest?
Well, first of all, I think if, you know, my kids were still young, I would be doing a daily GAIN meditation at dinner or on the weekends during other meals or other occasions. It can be done in a very short period of time. I think that the benefits are almost immediate. You know, for example, if you sit down with your family at dinner, many people do a prayer, what have you. But let's say you just do a gratitude exercise with your family and everybody holds hands or whatever. And you just go through how grateful you are to be sitting together, to have each other in your lives, to have the food that you're about to eat. I mean, these are worldwide age old concepts, nothing certainly that I've devised. But I think these things make an impact on everybody, including children, almost immediately. And then the more we practice them, the gratitude, acceptance, intention, and non-judgment, the more our minds begin to work in these ways. And so I think there can be some results almost immediately. But then after days and days and weeks and months of incorporating these practices into our life, you know, I think they make a big difference, even starting at a young age.
I agree with you. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Great to be with you again, Jamie. I look forward to our next conversation.
Thanks to all my wonderful guests, Dr. Ron Somogyi, Dr. Robert Satori, Christopher Hadnagy, and Dr. Greg Hammer. And thank you all for listening to The Tonic. You can listen or download this episode as a podcast with full show notes, contact information for our guests, and links at thetonic.ca. To find out more about the show, you can always follow us at It's The Tonic on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. For more timely, up-to-date, and accurate health and wellness information, subscribe to The Tonic newsletter. Now distributed once a week, The Tonic newsletter, with content curated personally by me, will keep you in the loop. There's contests, prizes, insider scoops, and so much more. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. If you're interested in providing feedback or suggesting topics for the show, you know you can always email me at jamie@thetonic.ca. On our next show, we'll discuss the health and wellness issues that are important to you. Until then, this is Jamie Bussin wishing you a healthy and happy week.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.